Our speaker this morning is John Bishop. I met him probably, I've been married 39 years, so We probably met a couple years after we were married. At that time, he was doing some wealth management, insurance thing, which I'm still probably you're still involved in today. His topic today is basically about the battle, and it there's lots of spiritual implications with war and dressing as a warrior and, you know, being prepared for crises and that kind of thing. So I'm sure we'll get a lot of great insights from that. All right, John, you're up.
To get a feel for where I'm coming from and why I am motivated the way I am, I want to share a little bit of my testimony, a little bit of my background. I grew up in Kansas City, and at 17, a senior in high school, my dad went over with a heart attack and died, and we were a pretty low-income, middle-income family at best. So college, which had been my mother's dream for me because she came through the Depression, and that was her dream to go to college, and she never got to do it. But when he passed away, all hope of ever having a shot at college just evaporated. So this is 1960, and like a lot of young men at that time, I enlisted in the Navy to serve. We're only 15 years out of World War II, and that was still a big issue with young men. But also to get access to the GI Bill. So I take off for San Diego, and two major things happened, trajectory-changing things in my life. First of all, back in those days, chapel was mandatory for all the recruits. So every Sunday morning, they form up 3,000 or 4,000 recruits, march us over this big auditorium. And I could not have said it this way at that time, but all the Navy chaplains were evangelicals. And so every Sunday morning, 3,000 to 4,000 sailors were hearing clear message of Jesus and the gospel. And one Sunday it just clicked. It just made sense. I said, that's for me. So I went forward, and that's when my conscious journey with Jesus began. But the second thing that happened was I was sitting in the office clerking for the battalion officer, and one day he looked over and he said, Bishop, he said, I think you should go to the Naval Academy. And I sort of looked up and said, I don't know anything about this. I'm from Kansas. Every boy in Kansas knew about West Point because Eisenhower was a West Pointer and a favorite son out of World War II. I said, I didn't know a thing about the Naval Academy. He said, no, I think you ought to go. And to get a feel for the hand of God working in a young man's life. This is a W-4, one officer four, bosun's mate, World War II veteran, mentoring an E-1, the lowest ranking enlisted guy in the service. Not even really an E-1, I'm a recruit. And he mentored me through the entire process and to the point where I could get this appointment to go to the Naval Academy. So it's the hand of God in a special way that I've learned over these years really to recognize and appreciate. So I wound up going to the Naval Academy, graduated in 1965, and opted at that time to take my commission in the Marine Corps. Two reasons, two primary reasons, one noble, one just sort of life. The noble reason was that I believe every person has a certain capacity for leadership. I didn't know what my capacity was at 21 years old, but I felt whatever that capacity was, the Marine Corps would better develop it than would the Navy. The second reason was after a cruise on a submarine and a destroyer and getting horribly seasick on both of them, I decided the life of the sailor wasn't the life for me. Left the academy in June 1965, landed in Vietnam in April of 1966, and spent a year out there with the 3rd Marine Division in the war. Got orders back to Washington, D.C. as a first lieutenant, which was highly unusual. In fact, the general officer, when I checked in, commented how unusual it was they'd send a first lieutenant to headquarters Marine Corps. But it was while I was at headquarters, I was still a relatively new believer and been taught by the Officers Christian Fellowship, that when you get to a new duty station, check in with a chapel or a local church, but get engaged. First thing you do is get engaged. And at that time, there are no really operating chapels in the D.C. area. So I went out here to 4th Presbyterian Church, and Dick Halverson was the pastor, and that's where I met Doug Coe and Bob Strain and Fred Hine and all the folks supporting the Congress in this thing called the National Prayer Breakfast, and ultimately resigned my commission to go full-time with those folks in supporting this tremendous ministry of reconciliation and linking people together in the name of Jesus. I share that because every experience in life, to some degree, shapes you. And when we're young in life, those early childhood experiences shape us. And I think the same thing is true in our early journey of faith. We're shaped by those early experiences. And so for me, my first 12 years of journeying with Jesus was either learning about war, training for war, going to war, recovering from war. Everything was warfare. And it was intense. For those of you that can remember the Vietnam War and the anti-war movement that time in history, it was pretty intense. And so that's what shaped me in my early journey with Jesus, is this whole idea of warfare, which translates into spiritual warfare. When I left the Marine Corps and went to work with the fellowship here on the breakfast, the anti-war movement in this town was pretty, really intense. And so being a Vietnam veteran was not a positive thing. And being a Marine Corps Vietnam veteran was really not a positive thing. And so that had a real debilitating effect on trying to fit in, trying to be part of this ministry, trying to reconcile people, trying to create dialogue, love, and relationship. Just didn't work wearing kind of this military veteran hat. So I did everything I could to jettison that, to demilitarize myself, to sort of deny that history to a certain degree in order to fit in and to be part of this ministry. In 2007, I went back to Vietnam. Almost 40 years to the day I had left, I went back. I left on April 15th, I went back April 28th, 40 years. And as you can imagine, that experience after 40 years was a pretty somber, reflective time to ponder the events and circumstances that I had experienced 40 years prior. And I'm riding the bus over to Khe Sanh. And for those of you who remember the war, the siege of Khe Sanh, the Battle of Khe Sanh, was probably the bloodiest part of the war for the Marine Corps. Terrible military position down in the valley, and the North Vietnamese coming across the DMZ just hammered the Marines that were there. But while I'm riding this bus, obviously I'm reflecting, I'm thinking of experiences that I'd had, I'm thinking of guys that had died. I thought of Bucky Egan. Bucky and I played cribbage. He taught me how to play cribbage. And so in the downtime when we were in garrison, played a lot of cribbage, and his track vehicle went over a landmine, and he and six other Marines were killed instantly. So those kind of things come to mind. I hadn't thought about that stuff in 40 years. But while I'm doing this, I started thinking about my life and how I got to where I am, and this whole thing of what happened to me when I was an enlisted guy, getting to the academy, getting in the Marine Corps, and I realized I jettisoned that stuff. I denied it. So I just said, Lord, getting to go to the Naval Academy, that is not something that's insignificant. There are not a lot of men then and now, men and women who qualify, who get to do something like that, or the Marine Corps wearing the Eagle, Globe, and Anchor. So I said, Lord, those are just now too significant of events for me to not ask the question, what's that all about? And men, to the degree that I think I hear the Lord, I believe I heard him say to me, those days were for these days. And so I put back on my spiritual warfare, my warfare lenses, and looking at life, looking at faith, looking at everything that I'm doing through the lenses of this reality of spiritual warfare. Jesus and every writer of New Testament scripture speaks of spiritual warfare. Not every book, but every writer, and Jesus particularly. So it's a reality in this thing we call faith. It's a reality of this thing in journey with Jesus that, frankly, I think too many of us deny or ignore or simply don't pay attention to it. Let me see if I can illustrate that. How many of you are familiar with the passage where Jesus says, I've come that you might have life and have it abundantly? That's the second half of John 10:10. Now, just by a show of hands, how many of you can tell me the first half? Usually there's one. He's heard this before. So, the first half of John 10:10 says, the thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy. I've come that you might have life and have it abundantly. And I'm not a theologian, but I think I know enough about theology to know it's bad theology to take a verse, split it, and only build your theology around that second half. I'm convinced that the abundant life that Jesus is talking about comes from getting in the fight to keep the thief from killing, stealing, and destroying. And the degree to which we get in that fight and prevent him from doing that, that's how we begin to establish the kingdom. I want you to think for a minute. Columbine, Aurora, Virginia Tech, Sandy Hook, San Bernardino, and now Las Vegas. We tend to look at those as separate and disconnected, isolated events. But folks, they are not. They're part of a coordinated agenda of the thief to steal, kill, and destroy. What they represent are times and places where the thief found a willing ally to help him carry out his agenda. I want to illustrate this another. When you look through spiritual warfare lens, you see different things, then you see other things differently. This is going to be an illustration. Can you read this, what the headline up here is? Across the top, what does that say? Washington Post. What would you call this? Fake news? a newspaper, right? That's what we see and that's what we think of as a newspaper. But I want to tell you what this really is. This is today's record of the thief's agenda yesterday. This is where the thief gets his glory. He gets his glory when his agenda gets published. Now, folks, Jesus has an agenda. And his agenda is to establish his kingdom. And Jesus needs allies in his agenda just the same way that Satan needs allies in his. So part of what I'm about is calling folks into this battle, into this engagement, to help establish the kingdom. So I want to be clear about that. Now, from these experiences, from those 12 years, and from what I've been processing ever since 2007, I've learned some things. And what I'd like to do is share just a couple of things that I've learned as a result of this time. The first thing I've learned is simply, we are at war. We are born and born again into a world at war. And to deny that, to not process that, simply allows us to continue to keep getting ambushed and marginalized and increasing our ineffectiveness because we're not dealing with reality. I think one of the great problems in the we have today, and I think most of you would agree, is there's a leadership issue across the board. Max DePree said the first responsibility of a leader is to define reality. When we don't define reality, we don't wind up leading very well. And the reality is we are at war and we've got to face it. Second thing I've learned is that in war, there are casualties. And in this spiritual war, this war in which we were born and born again into, we start our process in this war, we start as casualties. We are all wounded people. We're wounded from the fall, for sure. We're wounded sadly, sadly. Many of us have been wounded by the sins of others. And of course, we're wounded by our own sin and folly. But we're wounded people. We start our journey with Jesus as wounded folks. And so part of this process, part of what we're really about, I hope, is transforming our wounds into scars. There is power living from a scar, no power living from your wounds. And what I'd like to do, I have an illustration to make the point. I don't know, anybody ever seen one of these before? You know what this is? It's the Purple Heart Medal. We award these to our warriors who are wounded in action and to the next of kin for those who are killed in action. And folks, I'm convinced that Jesus, when he was here, earned two of these. He was wounded for our transgressions and I believe was killed in action at the cross. I also believe that it's at the point of our woundedness that Jesus most desires to connect with us, most desires to engage with us at that level. And he wants to do for us what was done for him, is to turn those wounds into scars. So what I want to do is I'm going to pass this medal around, and when you grip it, I'd like you just in that moment to acknowledge that wound, that point in your life that even today may be having an impact on you. And seek in that moment to say, Jesus, I want to connect with you there. Okay? There's a whole lot more I could say about this idea of woundedness. The sadness that I think most people live with but don't have the opportunity to dialogue about, to address, because it is so painful. But I want to encourage all of us to recognize that that's the very point that Jesus wants to connect with us. There's another thing about this warfare that we're in and being wounded. In the military, we have a thing called the million-dollar wound. That's a wound that's bad enough to get you out of the battle and sent home, but not bad enough to disfigure or disable you. That's the million-dollar wound. In that case, you get healing by getting out of the battle. But healing with Jesus is like everything else with Jesus, just the opposite of what you would normally think. In Jesus, you live by dying. You get by giving. You lead by serving. First by being last. Weak, strong by being weak. Everything in this life in Jesus is the opposite. So for him and for us, healing comes from getting in the battle, not getting out of it. So that's part of the call, is to say, let's get in the battle. Let's get in the fight. That's where I'm going to experience the healing that Jesus intends for me. And one thing about a scar, when that happens, the scar never denies the reality of the wound. It never denies that. But it also testifies to the healing. And we want to be folks who give testimony to the healing power of grace, to the healing power that Jesus brings to us. Another thing I've learned in this process is that we have weapons with which to fight this war. That's based on 2 Corinthians 10:4. Paul says the weapons of our warfare are mighty. Not carnal, but mighty. That verse alone says we're at war and we have weapons. What I've discovered over this time of doing this is that most people do not know what a weapon is. They really don't. Not at least don't know it in the sense in which I think Paul is trying to talk to us about in 2 Corinthians. So I've created a definition of weapon in order to help people better understand what Paul is saying to us. A weapon is anything you can use that destroys your enemy's ability to wage war against you. Let me say that again. A weapon is anything you can use that destroys your enemy's ability to wage war against you. So, this can write a note, take notes, write a book, but in the eye of an attacker, it becomes a weapon. A weapon is really defined by what it does, not what it is. So when you come into this spiritual battle, we have a whole arsenal of weapons. And I always start with the same two. The first one is forgiveness. Folks, when we forgive, we destroy Satan's ability to wage war against us through anger, bitterness, revenge, alienation, hostility. We simply take the fight to the enemy when we forgive. One of the most powerful weapons in our entire arsenal. The second one is generosity. When we're generous, we destroy Satan's ability to wage war against us through the love of money and the deceitfulness of riches. Those are primary. But there's other aspects of our generosity that we need to be thinking about. For example, we can be generous with our words of encouragement. As you move through the day, as you move through your business environment or wherever you're going, and you're generous with your words of encouragement, I'm willing to guarantee you that at some point in time, you're going to give a word of encouragement to someone for whom that becomes more valuable to them than money. But you take that weapon of encouragement, you turn that into a weapon because now you're taking the fight against Satan of his efforts to discourage that person. That's one of the ways we get in the fight. I always start with these two because they're two of the four cornerstones of God's love. God's love gives and God's love forgives. So I'm this is drill sergeant, Marine Corps. If you're not a giver and a forgiver, you're not a lover. I'm not really sure what you are, but I don't think you can lay claim to being a lover if you're not a giver and a forgiver. And something else I want to stress on this is that giving and forgiving has nothing to do with a percentage. When God gave, He gave all. He gave us all that He could give us when He gave us His Son. He didn't give us 10%. And when He forgives, He forgives all. There's no sin so large it cannot be forgiven, none so small it should not be forgiven. He forgives all. So our view of loving, of giving and forgiving needs to start with all. Different paradigm. Another weapon is a clear conscience. Paul says, I strive always to maintain a clear conscience. Folks, when we maintain a clear conscience, we destroy Satan's ability to wage war against us through guilt, shame, fear, anxiety. There's a whole raft of human issues that we destroy when we maintain a clear conscience. We eliminate Satan's ability to work against us in those areas, particularly fear, guilt, and shame. But we do that by maintaining a clear conscience. When I was in Vietnam, I carried an M16 and a 45, and my Marines carried hand grenades. Those are individual weapons. And so giving and forgiving and a clear conscience, those are individual weapons. But we also had a thing called crew-served weapons, weapons it took which for which it took a team to operate, artillery, tanks, machine guns, mortars, it took a team. In this spiritual warfare, fellowship becomes a crew-served weapon. When we band together as a little community of believers, little band of brothers, we begin to take the fight to the enemy in a completely different way. For example, we destroy Satan's ability to isolate us when we are committed and with a little band of brothers. Satan really hammers guys when they're isolated. I'll tell you a story, very sad. I did this down in Orlando a few years ago on November 6th. The reason I remember it was November 6th because that's my youngest daughter's birthday. And I talked about this. On Monday, I was contacted by one of the guys in the group, and he says, I need to understand more about this idea of spiritual warfare, because in that session I talked about how it affects men at their work, in their workplace. He said, because over the weekend, one of our men who was going through his third, being let go, I think, for the third time, committed suicide. Married, 5 children. One of those kids' birthday was Saturday, November 7th. And he was distressed about what had happened. And I heard that. I got angry. I got very angry. Because here was a man in a good church in Orlando, part of a men's group, but he was alone. And when you're alone, the siren song of Satan begins to make sense. They'll be better off without you. They can live off the insurance. You're a loser, yada, yada, yada. And so this guy killed himself. I still get a little angry when I think about it, because he was alone in a group just like this. When you get down to a few band of brothers, a few men that you're traveling with, that you're journeying with, you're doing life with, thinking of Peter, James, and John, you destroy Satan's ability to isolate you and to let that message become meaningful to you. It changes everything when you do things as part of a little company of brothers. Another aspect of this, we talk about forgiveness. There are certain circumstances, maybe amongst you, that forgiving is going to take a lot of courage. I did this yesterday, as a matter of fact, up in Connecticut, and one of the guys shared his testimony. His teenage daughter went to a fraternity party. Long story, she got raped. And this guy was blunt. He was absolutely blunt. He wants to kill the kid that raped his daughter. And he knows it. And he's feeling it. And he communicated it. And he's articulating it. But he says, I know I've got to forgive him. But he wasn't there. I don't think he can get there by himself. I think it's the other men that were sitting around that table who come in, close in on him, and work with him and encourage him. Courage comes from encouragement, and help him process that he's got to be able to forgive. So this fellowship, this idea of a little band of brothers, has enormous implications when it comes to being effective in using our individual weapons. Generosity. There may be things that God's laying on your heart to do. This India thing. I mean, there's all kinds of things out there that Jesus is doing, and it's all got to be financed. He never gives a checkbook to anybody and says, here, fill this out as you need it. His work gets cared for by his people. But maybe giving is something that takes courage. Maybe there's an issue. Well, you can draw that from being part of a little band of brothers. So we have these weapons, individual weapons, team weapons, unbelievable opportunity to create a different dynamic of how we're following Jesus. And I think this is where Earl Palmer is going to get to in his talk. We overcome evil with good. And so forgiveness is a way to overcome evil. Generosity is a way to overcome evil. Encouraging other people is a way to overcome evil. You start thinking about these things, but setting them in a warfare context gives you a motivation to get engaged that maybe you haven't had before, because there's a whole lot at stake if we don't. We're living here. I mentioned David earlier. I think we've got an enormous opportunity that's being created for us in the true gospel. What's happening in this world around us is a call, as I've never heard or seen before, to be a spokesman for the King. So those are the thoughts I wanted to share with you. We're at war. We're wounded. And we have weapons. But we need to engage together. So let me encourage you, when you leave here today and through the rest of the week and for the rest of your life, I want you to walk humbly, knowing the one before whom you someday must stand and give an account. But while you walk humbly, I want you to walk tall, because you're a friend of the King. And while you walk humbly and you walk tall, I want you to walk with others. Walk as part of a band of brothers. Semper Fidelis.